This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. I'm taping this interview from my home via Zoom, and our taping is mixed by Jason Sikora of Raider, our longtime sponsor. Raider is a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, "You just want it to work. We understand." Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank our premier sponsors. First, Iberia Bank. They support our community in so many ways, including this podcast, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit iberiabank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible. Lafayette General has been a leader in telemedicine. With the Health Anywhere app, your family can access quality urgent care at any time without an appointment, all from the comfort of home. It's the waiting room redefined. Download the app today at lghealthanywhere.com. Our guest today is attorney Michelle Bio, candidate for District Court Judge, Division K in Lafayette Parish. Michelle started her legal career 26 years ago. She first worked in the Orleans Parish DA's office. She moved to Lafayette 24 years ago and has worked as an assistant district attorney in Lafayette Parish under two DAs and two sheriffs. She is the lead felony prosecutor in Track 4, trying everything from felony theft to the most violent crimes. Michelle also has experience in family law, employment law, divorce, custody, child support, age discrimination, and sexual harassment. She is a founding team member of the Lafayette Parish Drug Court Program. Michelle Bio is currently running for the seat currently held by Judge Rick Michaud. Michelle Bio, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I want to thank you, first of all, for putting your name in the hat. Running for any type of office is very taxing, and it consumes you and your family, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It's been a crazy whirlwind 6 months, really.
Yeah.
Especially having made the decision, we had our announcement party on March 12th, and the world closed down on March 13th.
You know, I saw that. I looked on your Facebook site, and I want you to go through your background and all, but just mentioning that, I thought how lucky you were that you did it early, because the world hasn't been the same.
It's been a little crazy, right? Of course, I don't have anything to compare it to. I've never run for anything before, so I don't know how to do it in a under regular circumstances. But yes, it's been a little crazy. But
yeah, well, let's talk about your background. So you're running for judge. You've been working as an active attorney, trying cases. You've got a lot of experience in both civil and criminal. I know particularly criminal. But can you talk about your background, where you grew up, and then what led you to practice law?
Sure. Well, I grew up actually in New Orleans. I am one of four kids. My mom, Marilyn, and she was a nurse who helped put my father, Michael, through medical school. He was a psychoanalyst.
Wow.
I know, crazy, right?
Literally.
No. Literally, yeah, right? So he's going to figure us all out. But she was a stay-at-home mom once, he went and finished medical school and became a doctor. I had three siblings. We grew up in Lake Vista in New Orleans. That's where our home was. And, it was great. Great place to grow up, and I went to school at Edward Hines, which was the public elementary school over on Harrison Avenue, and then I went to, I guess it was seventh grade, I switched to a private school, to Ecole Classique, and that school was located uptown on Napoleon Avenue, excuse me, and it's a very small private school. The campus was made up of four old houses on Napoleon Avenue.
Oh, my.
And the playgrounds, their houses were pushed back half a block. And so the front blocks that faced Napoleon Avenue were playgrounds, but they were owned by the city. Mm-hmm. And so that was where we would go out to have PE, or when we had recess or lunch break, whenever we could go sit out on the parks. And of course, if a bunch of people who weren't in school came to play at the basketball court or whatever else, we all had to leave and go back into the classrooms and stuff because they didn't want us. I guess it was a safety issue or whatever. Right. I have no idea. But anyway, we always would hate when people would come, you know, use their park because we'd be like, wait, now we have to go back to class. I was there through, I graduated from Ecole Classique, but the summer between my junior and senior year, Ecole Classique bought another school called Sam Barth. And so Sam Barth was a big all boys school out in Metairie. And so we went from this little campus to this big campus out in Metairie that had, and all of a sudden we went from having nothing really. We did have a baseball team, and we had a, girls had a volleyball team when we were on Napoleon Avenue. But when we got to Sam Barth's campus, and we were able to have a football team because we had a football field, and we had...
That's a culture shock.
It was a big... I mean, my junior class was 23 people in the class, and my senior class was 50. So I doubled.
Oh, wow.
You know, just because a lot of those Sam Barth boys stayed.
Yeah.
Because it was their senior year. But anyway, it was interesting. It was fun. And
good memories, huh?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And so then I went to school I went to LSU for a year and a half. And... really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I don't think I was one of those students that was really dying to go away to school. I was kind of a homebody. But my parents thought it was a good idea to kind of, you know, spread your wings and go try it on your own. So I did, and I had a good time. But I think I was really not ready to leave home yet. So after a year and a half, I ended up coming back to New Orleans, and I ended up graduating from UNO.
Uh-huh.
And so after I graduated from UNO, my best friend had moved to California. And so I decided, well, I want to go see the world too, you know. And so I went out to visit her a few times. And then I told my mom, I'm going to go move to California and live there for a while. Mm-hmm. And my mom loves to tell the story. I packed up my car, and she tells the story of how I was, you know, she was standing in there on the sidewalk in front of the house and waving goodbye to me. And she felt like...
So sad.
Yeah, she said she felt like her whole world was just, you know, ending.
But she wanted to be supportive
she
at the
did,
same time.
But she thought that was so far away.
It was.
It is.
Yeah.
It is far away. But
I'm thinking of Joan Didion, you know, slouching to Bethlehem.
Yes.
I love those California stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So and it was a wonderful, I wanted an adventure, and it was a great adventure. My, you know, like I said, my best friend lived out there. And so, you know, I lived in Los Angeles. I lived in Hancock Park for a while in an old, very deco looking, apartment building, that was, I know Mae West lived there. I don't know if she owned it, but you know, that was the big celebrity.
Yeah.
That was known to be part of that big building. And so it was an adventure. It was fun. But after about a year and a half, I figured I better figure out what I'm going to do with my life. You know, this, I can't just do this forever. And so I did, I started applying to law schools, I ended up going to law school.
Yeah, you know? In California.
Yeah, I had applied to schools here and there, and you know, I was still living out there. So
yeah, the residency,
right?
It's a lot cheaper to go in state.
Yeah, so it was good. But while I was in law school, I did decide, I was like, okay, I really want to go home. I know, I'm ready to go back and live my life in Louisiana. This was a fun adventure and everything.
Right.
I find that so true of people from Louisiana. Mm-hmm. You know, we
boomerang.
Yes,
is what they call it.
Huh? Absolutely. Yeah. So many people I know wanted the adventure. They wanted to see. They moved to you know, London or New York or Los Angeles, Chicago, but they all ended up coming home eventually because there's really no place like Louisiana. I mean, we were very lucky, you know.
Now, let me ask you, since there's no place like Louisiana, you studied out of state. And I know people that have done that, and then you can study for our bar, but it's like we have a different type of bar exam than the rest of the country. So that must have been a challenge.
It was. I graduated, and the very next day I got on a plane and came back. My mom and two of her friends drove back across the country so my car could get back here. They went on a little girl's adventure driving my car back. But I came back the very next day because my bar review class started that Monday or something.
And you can really get what you need in that. It's intense.
It was intense, and it was, you know, it was a intimidating process only because, I was really afraid.
Civil code.
Like, how much am I going to not know? And, you know, so I just...
I think it's the same. It's just different words.
Exactly.
Same principles.
It is.
But still, it does seem different because there's a lot of French terms.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But you went to L'École, whatever.
École classique, yes. Yeah, well, I didn't know that much French. I did take French, but but anyway. So I did. I studied real hard and you know.
Yeah.
Passed the bar the first time, was very happy
That's
about
great.
That.
That's great.
They used to have, you know, now you can check it all online and all of that, you know.
Oh, really?
But at the time that I graduated, you couldn't, you know.
It was
and,
in person.
And they either mailed it to you or they did put a list on the doors of the Supreme Court. So you could go and, like, find your secret code and see, and they'd have the pass, the condition, or the fail.
I got mine in the mail.
I was actually interning at the district attorney's office in New Orleans at the time, and I remember I was in court, and
we all kind of knew when they were going to be posting it.
Oh, yeah.
The mail would come.
And actually, Eric LaFleur, in our state, he's a senator, I think, right? He was the lead prosecutor in the track that I was interning in at the DA's office in New Orleans. And he said, well, don't the bar results come out today? And they'll mail it to me or whatever. He goes, go check your bar results. Come on. And I said, all right, well, if I don't come back, it wasn't good news.
By myself.
So I did. And I went to the Supreme Court and I walked up to the doors and I'm looking for my code. And I went to the pass column and I looked and I was like, oh my God, there it is. And so I knew I passed, and I was like,
thank you, Lord.
So, yes. And I walked back to my car that I had parked about a block away, and I got almost to my car and I thought, I better double check. So I walked all the way back.
What if I'm wrong?
Yeah, what if I made a mistake? So anyway, that's
it. Did y'all have to give yourself like an alias? Like when I took
the code name you had to give, like.
I was Marie Bates.
I don't even
that
remember.
That was my grandmother's name.
I don't even
but
remember
that was
what
elegant,
I
elegant, you know.
Yeah. People have asked me that. I know people remember. I don't even remember the name
people
I used.
People came up with the silliest names.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Tracy,
Madonna,
you know, they would just come
whatever.
Up with Mae West probably.
Right.
It's
I have
funny.
No idea what I chose. Yeah. I just...
But that kept it anonymous.
But, you know, you could also at that time call and find out if you passed all the different sections or, you know...
Right.
I said, absolutely no way.
No.
I passed. I don't need to know anymore.
It doesn't matter. But for people listening that haven't experienced this or haven't had family, it's like, it's just the most unnerving thing because you've been through school and, you know, that seems like the worst part, but it really isn't.
It really
isn't.
Because
in the past, if you didn't take the bar, you weren't... license to practice. I know we're having a little issue this year with COVID, but passing the bar is it's just like becoming an architect or an accountant. Like it's just as grueling.
It's
getting
a
through
grueling
that
exam.
Process.
It is the whole process. And so, my heart always goes out to anybody who has to do it twice, you know, because it's exhausting.
It's tough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you met, should I say the love of your life in New Orleans?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that and what brought you here?
Sure. Well, I was an intern at the district attorney's office. My husband, Moose, was one of the lead felony prosecutors.
And
I say Moose. Yeah, see, it's so funny because I still always refer to him as Moose. Even when we got married, you know, the priest said, Lawrence, or do you, Michelle, take Lawrence? And I'm like, who's Lawrence? You know, but no, I knew his name. I'm just joking. But I call him Moose. Everybody calls him Moose. And so it's Lawrence Bio, but he goes by the nickname Moose. And so we met. He was, like I said, a lead felony prosecutor in the trials division, and I was just a lowly intern trying to get hired. Mm-hmm. So we started dating, and so when we decided to get married, he actually moved back to Lafayette probably within a year or so after I started there, and he came back. He knew he wanted to live here in Lafayette, and so we dated long distance for couple of years. And so when we decided to get married, he said, you know, I'd really love for you to come back to Lafayette and live here. But if you don't want to, you know, we can go wherever you want. He said, I'd prefer not to live in New Orleans, because having lived there, he was afraid. You know, when you work at the DA's office, you see the very worst things that happen in any community.
It's a different culture.
Yeah, so he just thought it was too much. He wanted a smaller town feel than New Orleans. And so, but he said, if you want to live to the North Shore, if you want to leave Louisiana, whatever you want to do.
My goodness.
So I said, no, you know, I've come to visit you in Lafayette enough times that I like Lafayette. Mm-hmm. Let's try it there. And obviously one of the best decisions we ever made, because it's a wonderful place to live. You know?
Now, he's got a large family, right? The Bios.
He certainly
does. This is Popey's.
Popey
Bio.
Popey's number 4. Mm-hmm. My husband, Moose, is number 12.
Now, how many did they have?
17 kids.
17. I interviewed Popey a while back, and I think their dad's name was Bozo.
Correct.
So does anybody just go by,
That's always the joke. You know, would they just run out of names because there were so many people? You know, they started coming up with nicknames. I don't really know why my father-in-law's name was Bozo. I don't know how he got his nickname, honestly.
I didn't want to ask Popey. I was like, maybe there's a good reason, you know?
Yeah.
I know he was quite the guy, though, and very accomplished.
The whole family. Yes, he's amazing. He was an amazing guy.
But I didn't ask.
Both of my I was very fortunate to have the in-laws that I did, because they're just sweet, wonderful people, very caring people. And Popey, I had always heard it was because his name was Robert Paul, and people started calling him Ropo, and somehow it turned into Popey, you know, so something like that.
But he's so kind.
He's a wonderful guy, too. He really is. I'm very fortunate, because, you could marry into a big family and have all kind of personalities, and there are a lot of personalities, but all just wonderful people, you know. I mean, a perfect example is, you know, when my in-laws both passed away, you know, you had 16 people. Two brothers-in-laws are deceased. So you had, and one of them, Martin, had a son. So his son stood in his place. But you have 16 people who have to go in and divide up this estate.
Yeah.
And not a single fight, not an argument, nothing. I mean, these were just, if they kind of did a drawing, you know, and you got to pick your number. And so when it was your turn, you got to, you know, pick, oh, I would like, you know, mom's antique desk, or, you know, and nobody fought or argued over it or anything. It was just sincere, you know, joy and happiness that the person who got what they got wanted, you know, got what they wanted.
The memory they wanted.
Yeah, and the memory they wanted. And so that's the kind of people that, you know, that I married into. So I'm very, very fortunate. They're wonderful people.
Well, let's, on that note, which is a wonderful note, let's take a pause, if you don't mind, Michelle.
Sure.
During every show, we pause for Discover Lafayette's Past. And this is brought to us by Rally Marketing, a full service digital marketing agency that can assist people with marketing automation, content development, and strategies on how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for their business. For more information, please visit rallymarketing.com. And now the moment, and I pulled this up because of your experience in the courthouse. So I want to encourage people, if you're driving downtown and going by the courthouse, take a moment to view the beautiful and historic structure at 217 West Main Street. And it's gorgeous. It was designed by architect George Knapp of Lafayette. The building was erected in 1898 and was the site of the Bank of Lafayette. On June 26, 1906, the building was sold to the Corporation of the Town of Lafayette for $4,500. In 1908, a prison was added to the rear of the building. The building was used as the City Hall until 1939, when the larger City Hall was built. The ground floor was then used by local women's organizations and as a library. In 1972, the building was declared unfit for occupancy. The building, which was listed on the National Register of Historic Places on June 10, 1975, is constructed on a very small parcel of land, and it's a typical two-story masonry commercial building with Rococo elements, which is kind of an older Baroque architecture. The second floor facade has a balcony with a semicircular brick arch above. And now I was confirming, Michelle, and you confirmed for me, that's where Codafil is.
That's my appreciation.
Yeah,
yes.
It's gorgeous.
It is beautiful, and I didn't know all that about
the building. I know, that's why we're discovering Lafayette's past.
Yeah.
I don't mean to make light of it. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. I had no idea that they had a jail or part of us, you know.
Well, when you walk out of the courthouse, you're probably, everybody's thinking, oh, I got to go here and there. And to take a moment and look at the architecture, that's the heart.
Well, we've all, I know, we've, you know, downtown. Colleagues and stuff have always talked about, and like, that's such a pretty building, you know. And we do have, we have quite a few really beautiful buildings in downtown Lafayette, if you really take the time, like you said, to look around.
Right.
But that one, like you said, coming right out of the courthouse doors, you see it, and it's a beautiful building.
Yeah, I encourage people to drive down there. So let's get back to what we're talking about. You moved here, and you were a practicing attorney at that point, so I understand you got some civil experience.
Well, when I first moved here, I went to work for an attorney here in town named Lisa Brenner. She was a very bright lady, an attorney. She kind of mentored me in a civil practice because I had up to then only worked in criminal law at the DA's office in New Orleans. And with her, she kind of had a general practice, so I got to do a bunch of different things, but primarily she had me working on some of her domestic cases, her family law cases, and then she had a big interest in sexual harassment cases and in age discrimination, those kinds of things. And so she kind of introduced me to all of that. And then she retired. I only worked with her for about a year, maybe a little bit more. And then she retired, she closed her practice. So I had to decide at that point whether or not I was going to go try apply to different firms, whether I was going to open my own practice. And so I decided to open my own practice because I figured, well, now's the time to do it, because if I go to a firm and get invested, I probably would never do that. So let me try that and see how I like it. And if it doesn't work out, then I can go apply to firms, you know, if I decide that's what I want to do. And so that's what I did. And I kind of kept my focus in those same areas. And I really did enjoy it. And, you know, it was fun kind of being your own boss. And I had never had that luxury before. Well, I call it a luxury because it is. You can make your own timetable, but you also then have to bring all the work in, you know.
It's a little stressful.
It can be. Yeah, it really can be. So, but it was great. It was a really good experience. I found, I enjoyed it. But I also went to work at that time with the public defender's office. And cause I still really enjoyed doing criminal work. And I had acquired so much experience in New Orleans when I was there. You know, when I was in New Orleans, I had worked for the district attorney's office. I started in the criminal non-support division. So I spent some time there. Then I was moved up to the juvenile division. And I served there for probably 6 months or a little bit more. And then I moved to the magistrate division.
Wow.
And then eventually made it to the felony trials division.
So you really saw a lot of different types.
I saw a lot of different types. And then in the felony trials division, you are very, very busy. Criminal court in New Orleans is you're in court every single day. It's not like the courthouse here. You have a separate courthouse that handles only criminal matters in New Orleans. Whereas here, you know, the district judges handle both civil and criminal. So, you get a lot of experience very quickly. You would be in court 5 days a week, trial set Monday through Thursday, Fridays were hearing days. You could have, you can easily have multiple trials in a week, but I there were times I had multiple trials in a day.
Wow, the preparation.
Well, just that's like, it. Yeah. But the way the district attorney's office worked there is a little bit different than how we work here in Lafayette. They had, we kind of have a vertical prosecution where the case comes in and it's assigned to the track that you're in, and then you review the report and decide whether you're going to accept charges or take it to grand jury, whatever, and then the case stays with you all the way through. Whereas in New Orleans, they have a whole screening division where, so those attorneys that are assigned to screening, they take the cases in, they put the cases together, they accept charges or bring it to grand jury and all that.
Pick it up.
And then it gets sent to the trials division. So when the file would come to you in trials, it's supposed to be ready to hit the ground running. You're supposed to have all your witnesses, everything there. Doesn't always work out that way, but but that's the idea.
Perry Mason.
Exactly. And so you do. You get a lot of a lot of trial experience because you are gonna be trying a lot of cases. And it was a great training ground. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, as a young lawyer, eager to learn and to want to be in court and wanting to try cases, I mean, you get that experience, and you know, and you work 7 days a week. It's not something I would want to do as once I started a family and all of that, at least not in the trials division. Maybe you can work in other divisions where it would be more conducive to family life. But as a young single person, it was wonderful because you could get that experience. But you would work. The only way you knew it was a weekend was because you didn't have to go in at 7:30 in the morning, and you could go in blue jeans and a shirt. You know, you didn't have to be dressed up. And but you worked every single day, and
you must have been a godsend when you moved here. Well, you know, like they probably didn't have many people that had that kind of experience.
Well, it was, you know, It was a wonderful thing for me when I finally moved here, because although it's a great training ground, to be able to have the time to actually feel like, you know, the luxury of really working your case up, mm-hmm. and everything, and making those decisions yourself. I mean, I get to make the decision whether or not I'm going to accept the charge or take it to grand jury, and I get to meet with the victims ahead of time and, you know, make all those kind of calls, whereas there, you're just, mm-hmm. basically taking on a case somebody else decided, made all those decisions on.
Right.
You know? So that's a luxury. So when I came here, I went back to work at in the criminal division, or the criminal realm rather, working for the public defender's office.
Right.
But because I had all that experience, mm-hmm. I was put in the position of a section chief, which meant that I was in charge of all the full-time public defenders at that time. And I also carried a caseload of my own representing clients with felony, mm-hmm. charges.
A question. I've never practiced criminal law, and I don't know that I have I don't know what it is. I think you've got to, I mean, you look so feminine and beautiful, but you've got to be kind of tough, you know, to be in there, because you're seeing a lot. Whether you're defending,
sure.
or prosecuting, you've got to deal with the victims and the alleged perpetrator, and it's tough because it's like nobody wants to be there, and it's not a happy situation.
Well, I find the best way to deal with that is to be prepared. And I always was prepared, and I always am prepared. I don't go into court unprepared. And mm-hmm. You know, if you do your homework, mm-hmm. Then, you know, you can be as impressive as you want to be, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I always approach my cases wanting to get justice for anyone who's wronged, who's harmed, you know, as a prosecutor. As a defense attorney, it was always to protect the rights of my client and make sure that, mm-hmm. You know, hold the state to their burden,
yeah.
you know, and that they have to prove their case, you know.
Right.
It is fast. Criminal work is very fast paced, and mm-hmm. It's not dull. You know, you're in court a lot. You're working. You're using your brain. You have to be quick on your feet a lot of the time because you are in court making arguments and so forth. So, that's kind of always been, mm-hmm. I don't know, the challenging the fun part of
right.
of being a lawyer. You have kind of being in court and having to think on your feet like
right.
that. And
when did you join the DA's office? When did that
here occur? In Lafayette? Uh-huh. It was 2002.
Okay, so you've been there a while.
Yes. So January of 2002 was
okay.
when I first started.
So 18 years.
Yeah.
So you've been under two DAs and two different sheriffs, and you must have got, I mean, you've gotten a ton of experience. I know that y'all try cases like you're saying, and so many lawyers do not try cases these days.
Right.
Especially on the civil practice, but
we try a lot of cases. You know, obviously you can't try every single case, and so there's so many cases that mm-hmm. come through. You know, ideally you try to work out as many cases as you can, come to an mm-hmm. agreement. And so we do. We work out a lot of cases, but those, typically the cases we end up trying a lot of are those cases that are really truly violent offenses.
Yeah.
So, you know, your murders, your rapes and armed robberies, home invasions, those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
because you're looking at big numbers if they're convicted of going to prison for a long time.
Right.
Sometimes you're the rest of your life, you know, and so those are not always the cases that can be worked out. So, mm-hmm. you know, even if you have a very strong case and right. so those are the cases you have to try. And
right. Well, I know that you've decided again to run for Division K District Court Judge in Lafayette Parish, and that seat is currently held by Rick Michaud, Judge
Rick Michaud.
Yes. And I know he's retiring, and so that's an open seat.
He is retiring. I don't think he would if he didn't have to. I think he still enjoys what he does. I'm guessing this.
The age thing. Huh?
But yeah, he's going to be, he's over 70 come November, so he has
it's hard
to retire.
Believe.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Well, he's still very active and very, mm-hmm. mean, most people I've said that to, it's an open seat. He's retiring because he has to. They're like, really?
It's
70?
Because
it's hard to believe that. Yeah. And he's always been a very active person, so he's, you mm-hmm. know, he still looks very youthful.
Yeah. So what made you decide to run for judge?
Well, the fact that you had mentioned something about the track system earlier, and mm-hmm. you didn't really understand that. The way the criminal court system works in Lafayette Parish is we are divided up into a track system. So tracks 2 through 5 handle all felonies that are non-drugs. And then track 1 handles all the drug charges.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm in track 4, so mm-hmm. that means I handle all of the non-drug felonies. And the judges will be assigned to a track. And so for the last 8 years or so, Judge Michaud has been assigned to track 4.
Okay.
And there's other complications or explanations as to how the judges figure all that out. But primarily, that's how mm-hmm. it's worked out, is that he's been in track 4. So I've practiced not exclusively, but predominantly in front of him for the last 8 years or so. And so when I did come to realize that he was going to be retiring, I started thinking about, you know, oh, well, you know, who's going to be coming in here? You know, who's going to be taking over his seat?
Because you're going to be seeing them a lot.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, okay. And I, you know, you just start thinking about, well, what is it that you start, you know, what is it that I'm looking for in a judge? What would I want the person? And first and foremost to me is I want someone who's experienced to come in and take that seat, mm-hmm. you know, who has experience in court, in the courtroom, knows how to try cases, know what goes into preparing a case for trial or defending a case. And so that kind of started to get me thinking about it a little bit. And then I had several different people approach me to say, you know, you really should think about this. You have a lot of courtroom experience. You would be great doing this. And at first I was like, well, I don't know, you know. And so the more they brought it up to me and the more I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, Michelle, you really can't complain if someone comes in and takes a seat that you're not happy with, if you don't yourself, knowing you have mm-hmm. all this experience to offer, if you yourself don't step up and at least, you know, try to fill the seat yourself, because you know you have the experience to
right.
do the job.
Right.
And so that's kind of what got me to say, okay, well, mm-hmm. you know, because I really, it's not like, you know, I've heard other people say, oh, I've always wanted to be a judge. It really wasn't on my radar even 5 years ago. You know, I mean, yeah. I never really thought about it. I love being a prosecutor and I love my job and I love helping people and seeking justice and, you know, mm-hmm. feeling like what I'm doing is important for my community and so forth. And so, so it really wasn't on my radar, but that's kind of how I got to this position. And, you know, I mean, I obviously judges do a lot to help the community too.
Oh, yeah.
And so I do have a certain, I've called it a calling to public service, because that is really where I feel the most fulfilled. You know, mm-hmm. I enjoyed my private practice and, you know, you can help people in private practice, no doubt. But I really do enjoy working, in the public sector and,
right.
and in the, particularly obviously in the criminal section, because, it's a wonderful feeling to know that you have helped a family who maybe lost someone, you know, to try to seek justice. You can't ever fill that void of the loved one they lost, mm-hmm. but certainly knowing that you helped them to seek justice for the loss of their
find resolution with what happened.
Somewhat, you know, and it doesn't that, you know, I guess they never really find closure because they've still lost their loved one, but that's a wonderful feeling. And I can also tell you, and it might sound crazy to you, but I've had people I've convicted that I've seen later say, thank you mm-hmm. for convicting me because you saved my life. You know, by
isn't that something?
It is, but it really, you know, so that's gratifying, but oh, mm-hmm. so humbling,
yeah.
you know, to know. So it just is. It's a very gratifying mm-hmm. field to right. work in, you know.
What is the role of a district court judge? You were saying that Judge Michaud, you know, oversees Track 4, but they see more than just criminal cases.
Oh,
so
oh,
what is the role of
well,
district court judge?
The district court judge is going to handle all of the different criminal type cases, and he just happens to have been assigned to Track 4 for a number of years. But, you know, you have a district court judge who's assigned to Track 1 who handles mm-hmm. the drug charges and stuff. But they hear misdemeanor cases as well. They hear traffic. They hear juvenile. They hear all kinds of civil cases.
Like lawsuits.
Lawsuits, family law. Mm-hmm. You know, so district...
Oh, they hear family law also?
The family court seats in district court primarily handle family mm-hmm. Court matters, except that certain cases can be heard by the other district court judges okay. as well, particularly if there's any kind of a conflict or mm-hmm. if there's not necessarily children involved, that kind of thing.
I see.
Or just divorces, that kind of thing.
Right.
You cover kind mm-hmm. of the full gamut of everything.
Yeah, you know? And you bring in that experience to the table. And I'm curious your thoughts. You really have handled a lot of different types of legal cases. What kind of temperament does a good judge need, and how do you think you show up for that role?
I do think I think temperament is really important. I mean, respect, you know, it costs you nothing to be kind and respectful to another person, you know, and so to me, respect is very important for a judge to come in, not just to demand respect from the people in the courtroom, but to actually show respect to others. And to the attorneys, you know, attorneys come in, they've worked hard on their cases, you know, so they deserve the respect. The parties who are there, the witnesses, the jurors who have taken time out of their busy days to come in and participate in judicial process. So respect is very important. You know, I love being in court, but I realize other people may not love it so much, you know, and so it can be really scary if you, you know, you're usually coming to court because it's something negative. You've either been harmed or you've harmed someone or you're accused of harming someone, and it could be civil or criminal either way. But you know, or you're going through a divorce, you're mm-hmm. going, you know, fighting over your kids or over property. So it can oftentimes be really daunting and scary. And so I think that having a judge who can be respectful and just be kind, you know, that's really important. It will help ease the process. So mm-hmm. certainly I feel I try to do that now as a prosecutor. You know, I always try to be respectful to even the defendant and the defendant's family. You know, mm-hmm. they have. You know, yeah. we're all human beings, you know, so that's,
right.
I, you know, so I think that I can bring that to the courtroom, and that's what I, certainly my goal.
Right. Now, I know that in the introduction, I was saying you're a founding team member of the Lafayette Parish Drug Court Program, and I've heard you say that you are a proponent of specialty courts. Can you talk about that, what those
sure.
are?
Well, I was one of the founding members when I worked for the Public Defender's Office. It was when drug court was first you know, in the mm-hmm. in the concept stage, and so I represented the Public Defender's Office. Actually, Rick Michaud was the judge who started with it, and Janet Paradin was the district attorney, the assistant district attorney, and so we went to a lot of training. We did different things. Judge Edwards came in shortly after that and took over when Judge Michaud handed it over to him, and he's been running or at
yeah.
the helm of it now for 20-something years, but it's a wonderful program that helps nonviolent offenders to hopefully maybe find sobriety, you know, and if they've come into court and it's not just drug charges. Most of the time it is a drug charge, mm-hmm. but they accept other charges such as, you know, let's say theft or say you burglarized someone's shed and stole a bicycle, you know, or something like that. I mean, it can be other charges
right.
as well. The idea being after the individual's assessed that we realize it's because they have a drug problem
yeah.
that they've done and become involved in this other criminal behavior. So It's been a very successful program, and I'm very proud to have been a part of it and help get it off the ground. And I'm very grateful to Judge Edwards and the other attorneys now who have stepped in and continued it all these years. And I'm happy to say that it's still going strong. And so I know that Judge Edwards has also started steps to try to introduce or build a veterans court. And so I am very interested in making sure that that happens, and that just because he is stepping down from district court and running for city court, mm-hmm. that we don't lose those other specialty courts. So I've been advocating that I absolutely am for the specialty courts. Anytime you can rehabilitate someone rather than incarcerate them, it's a benefit to that individual, mm-hmm. but it's a benefit to all of us. Especially with veterans, we have men and women, they've served for us. And when they come back to civilian life, there's all kinds of reasons why they may have made a bad choice. It could be PTSD, mm-hmm. Depression. Could be as simple as unemployment. Times are hard, and they make some bad choices and they find themselves in criminal court. So if it's a nonviolent offense, it would be, I think, beneficial to all of us to help them try to get back on the right mm-hmm. track, get them some services. There are some other veterans courts around the state, and I know that steps have been taken to already speak with the VA, and oh. I think that I think it will be able to be gotten off the ground, and right. I really just want to make sure that that continues. And so I'm a big proponent of it. Anytime we can help someone help themselves, mm-hmm. As I said, I gave that example of someone that I convicted and I've had situations where, I've been in court and I saw someone who I represented in drug court and I, said, oh, what are you doing here? And they were actually there with someone that they knew who got in trouble and appearing in court with them to try to help them, to try to get them into drug court so that they could mm-hmm. then be a healthy contributing
right.
member.
Right.
So that's really, again, you really feel like, okay, see, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan once said, you can't help everyone, but everyone can help someone.
Yeah.
And
it's beautiful.
It really is. And it's so true. And I think that's what our specialty mm-hmm. courts do. They're not going to save everyone. They're not going to help everyone. But, even mm-hmm. if we help a few people each year,
right.
wonderful.
So these courts, Michelle, and I know you had mentioned something, I think online I saw about mental health specialty court also, but whichever the focus is, the bottom line is that people are identified as maybe needing a little bit more assistance and that with some help, they can be rehabilitated.
That's
keep them out of jail, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As long as they comply.
Yes, exactly. I would love to see the courts work more with some mental health agencies And again, it's all stuff that's going to have to try to be, you have to have funds for all this kind of stuff, and you mm-hmm. have to apply for grants, and there are grants out there and so forth. And I don't need to reinvent the wheel. Judge Edwards has already tried to do some of these things and has gotten some things in place. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we can continue to that momentum and keep them going.
But the importance of these specialty courts is that people that need the help, though, I'm trying to think, like mental illness, there's so many people, I'm sure, that are in the prisons that they really don't belong there. But they really probably needed
yes.
much more intervention than just being incarcerated.
Absolutely.
I
mean, we have people, and oftentimes dual diagnosed, Like in the sense that they may have the drug problem because they are self-medicating.
Right.
Absolutely. Or just, homeless, mm-hmm. Living on the streets. And if we can try to get the services for people, nonviolent offenders to, find shelter, find jobs. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of education as well. I mean, I think that's truly key.
Yeah.
And obviously it's going to take more than one judge to try to do all these kinds of things. But the idea, and I think for the most part, most people want to help other people if mm-hmm. they can to try to get back on track. And so I would love to see us be able to help these nonviolent offenders get the services they need, training they need, so forth, to be able
and
to
follow
come.
Up with them.
Yes,
yeah.
To become, we incarcerate people sometimes now, and they just sit there.
I know. That's what Judge Edwards told me. I interviewed him recently, yeah. And he said, you know, the worst thing you can do is put someone in jail for a long time because they're just hanging out with other bad people. You know?
And he's absolutely right on that. Yeah, and they're doing nothing. You know, I mean, like if we can,
He didn't mean like violent, like
violent. Right.
But he was talking about some people just don't really need to be in prison.
Right. And you know, I would love to see us be able to, you know, and obviously this is not, you know, we'd have to have a committee of people, the DA, the public defender, the sheriff for sure, yeah. You know, all these different people would have to want to work on it. But, you know, if we could get programs where they would get education or they could get actual training while mm-hmm. they're, so that they can learn a vocation while they're in school,
right.
in jail, that when they get out, mm-hmm. they could actually make a living or do something other than
and not have to return
just
to
learn
the street.
Return to the street and learn whatever yeah. other criminal enterprises they learned while
right.
they were incarcerated, you know.
I'm trying to think who told me this. I can't remember what interview it was, Michelle, but somebody was saying, boy, if you could take drug dealers and like put them in charge of a business, they have got the best math minds. They know how to get things organized, you know, but they've just chosen a path that isn't really in their best interest or our best interest.
Well, that's true. And of course, oftentimes those businesses are not going to pay off as quickly as dealing drugs, but you have, you know, if they certainly have the minds to be able to do it the right way.
But you can live past your late 20s, you know, so.
Exactly.
And I shouldn't say it like that, but I mean, it's people get on the wrong track and they don't have the skills they need,
yes,
you know, for regular jobs, and they end up, that's the people you see a lot of the time. So, well, let me ask you this. You're running for Division K, and I heard you speak about this. I looked online. Again, you've got some videos on your Facebook, Michelle Bio for Judge, and it's a very big district.
It's
huge. Three districts, right, in Lafayette Parish.
There are three voting districts.
You've got a big one.
Right. So you have three voting districts in Lafayette Parish, and so District 1 is kind of sandwiched between 2 and 3, and that is, I guess, called the minority seats because it was kind of cut out to assure that we could have, that minorities would be elected would have a voice. So we do have two seats that are open. Both of those seats are open for this November. It's because both Judge Edwards is letting go of his district seat to run for city court, and then Judge Rubin is over 70, so he's going to be retiring. So both of those seats are open. You also have District 2, which is the seat that's held by Michelle Bro, and so
she didn't have opposition,
yeah. So she is the judge in that district. And then you have District 3, which is made up of, I believe, five other judges that all...
Okay.
So you have the two family court judges, Judge Michaud, Judge Castle, and Judge DePlanchet, who all have that district. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge district.
It is. I mean, it starts with the Western Parish line. You've got, if you want to just explain.
Yeah, so you really, you know, from the northern part of the district, it kind of starts, I guess, it kind of takes steps up and down on some places. But if you kind of go across Cameron, so everything south of Cameron is District 3. And then it goes all the way to the parish line to the west. And then all the way down south to...
By the airport?
Well, then we have that side, we have the airport, and then Upper Lafayette is kind of cut out, and you have a lot of nooks and crannies because that's kind of split up between District 1 and District 3. And then you have all of Youngsville and all of Broussard. And so going along the top there, too, you still had most of Scott, most of Doosan, you know, so it's... All those little towns
are
not
Lafayette.
Little towns anymore, you know, and then all of Lafayette Central, you know, and so it's 115,000 registered voters in that district.
Gosh, are you walking?
I am. I'm out there. You'll see me with my little wagon. I have my wagon with my ice chest and my signs, and I'm doing my best to try to hit every neighborhood I can between now and November, you know, just to... You know, right now, the crazy times we're living in, it is hard. You can't really have functions like you know, you normally would during an election cycle. So you having these big fundraisers or meet and greets that we would normally have, it's not safe. So we're not having them. And so the only way to really get out and meet people is to get on the street, knock on the door, and, right. and say hello. And so my experience has been very positive. People are grateful that you're coming to them mm-hmm. and sharing your information. And, oh. And you know, if they are afraid or don't want to answer the door, I've had people, they're still very nice. They usually you'll just wave or, mm-hmm. you know, and say, no, thank you.
You leave your card.
And I just tell them I'm leaving it on the door and they say, okay, thank you very much. Yeah. You know, so people are very, very nice and they're grateful mm-hmm. for the opportunity to meet you and ask you questions if they want to ask you questions. And yeah. so it's been positive. It's just a lot of walking.
Yes. Boy, that's a big district.
Yeah.
So the election is when?
November 3rd, so it's the same as the presidential election.
So there's going to be a lot to vote for.
A whole lot. Depending on where you live, you're going to have different number of judges that you can vote for. Obviously, we have 6 seats in district court that are going to be open in the 15th Judicial District.
Gosh.
The 15th Judicial District is made up of Lafayette, Vermilion, mm-hmm. and Acadia Parish. So we have one seat in Acadia, one seat in Vermilion, and then the other 4 in Lafayette Parish that are going to be vacant. And so...
That's a lot of turnover.
That's a lot of turnover in district court. And then city court, you have Judge Bouillon's retiring, so you have that seat that you have mm-hmm. candidates running for. And then we have district attorney. Keith yeah. Stutes is retiring, and so we have two people running for that seat. And
a marshal.
Oh yeah, city marshal. I did forget about the city marshal race. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that presidential race is really going to be pulling a lot of people to the poll.
I think so. I uh-huh. think certainly for the November 3rd, we should have a really big turnout, and so you know that's why I think it's important to get mm-hmm. out there and tell yeah. everybody who I am. You know,
right.
So,
what is the is there one or two questions that you hear over and over? Like, what are people curious about?
Oh, my goodness. You know, usually if I can kind of give my little spiel about, mm-hmm. you know, what I want to accomplish and what I've done in my experience and my qualifications, usually the response I get is, well, that sounds great because,
you kind of answered any questions.
Yeah, oftentimes I have. I mean, and now occasionally they'll ask me a question about a particular issue. One lady in particular, I remember, was very unhappy with the police. So she was asking me about mm-hmm. defunding the police and stuff like that. And it's very hard because people do want... They want to know who you are and where you stand. And as a candidate, I want to be able to tell you that too. You know, the rules of ethics basically say we are not allowed to publicly take a stance on one side or other of a particular issue.
Like abortion or something. Or supposed to. Not that you have any control over that.
Right, you know? Exactly. But uh-huh. you really can't speak on one side or the other of any issue because you never know if that issue would come before you, you know, or you're really supposed to be impartial and, mm-hmm. and always appear to be impartial. And it's really not even about my stance because as a judge, I have to listen to the facts and apply the law to those facts, not what my personal feelings are. Mm-hmm. I don't get to put my personal feelings in the mix,
right.
you know.
Or change the law.
Or change the law because that's exactly right. That's not the job of a judge, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't make the law, you know. I would only apply the law that
right.
we have. And so, I'm a firm believer in that too. I think there are rules that we have and I'm a rule follower. Mm-hmm. I'm going to follow those rules. So sometimes somebody might ask you a question that you can't really answer. And I've given them mm-hmm. my answer and sometimes they like it. Sometimes they don't. Most of the time they understand that, you mm-hmm. know, cause I think honestly, we all want a judge who's going to follow the rules.
Yeah.
If you're not going to follow the rules while you're campaigning, what's going to happen when you're on the bench? Right.
Yeah.
You know, so most of the time, really, honestly, all the different people I've talked to, I probably can think of, one person who was not happy with the answer, and then, you know, when I told him, I said, well, don't you want a judge who's going to follow the rules? He said, yeah, I do.
Yeah, I guess so, if I have to.
Yeah. I said, you know, and he did. And when he thought about that, he's like, you're right. Mm-hmm. I understand, you know. I said, so what I think doesn't mm-hmm. matter. So anyway.
I ran for office in the past, and I really enjoyed meeting people. And you just, it can be humorous, it can be poignant, you know, and... But they do. People want to talk, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They want to talk about federal government and what do you think about this. And
oh, yeah.
I just found it to be fascinating because you really do get to know the community. much better.
Yeah. People, I'm amazed at how friendly people really are. Mm-hmm. You know, that was always my concern about knocking on somebody's door. Like, am I interrupting them on their Saturday morning or whatever? Yeah. And for the most part, people are, even if they answer the door and at first like, oh, okay, thank you. And if I, you know, after I've said a couple of sentences, you know, they'll stop and listen to what, you know, and so they're very, very nice. Mm-hmm. You know, people are.
It's great.
Yeah.
We'll have one last question. You talked about people, you know, you tell them your qualifications, your experience, and what you want to accomplish. Do you want to share that, like that part of your message, what you want to accomplish if you are elected judge? Is there like an overriding place in your heart, you know, that you want to share with us about why, what you can accomplish if you're elected?
You know, when I talk to people, what I tell them is, you know, I always like to tell them my qualifications, that I started my, you know, that I'm been with the DA's office 20 years. I've been there as a felony prosecutor. I try cases ranging from felony theft to first degree murder, everything in between, you know, so that they kind of know what I do. You know, I help start, I said, but I do believe in rehabilitation over incarceration when that's appropriate, and I help start the drug court program. And so I really want people to understand that, I strongly believe in law and order when that's appropriate, you know, when it's appropriate to really enforce mm-hmm. law and order, like with violent offenders. You know, if a violent offender has hurt someone, then they need to be held appropriately accountable if they're convicted, in my opinion. But I want people, you know, I believe that it is important to have rehabilitation over incarceration because it helps our whole community. If we can help nonviolent offenders to get back on track with their lives and become contributing members of our community rather than just living off the community, then that helps all of us, you know? And so that's really what I want to try to accomplish once I'm on the bench, is to keep the momentum of some of these specialty courts that are already up and running, as well as introduce some of these mm-hmm. new ones, like a veterans court and mental health court if we can, and try to accomplish helping those individuals. And then it frees our courts up and even our jails up and mm-hmm. to deal with those truly violent offenders who we all want off the streets and want protection from, and who we want to be held accountable. And also it allows the court to deal with the other legal issues that they have, civil issues and, you know, family issues. And so I think, I truly believe overall, if we can kind of take another look at who, what we can do to help people help themselves mm-hmm. to lead a law-abiding life and try to help them on that road, that's going to benefit all of us. And you know, so I'd like the opportunity to try. You know?
Well, Michelle V, I want to thank you so much for your time today and for running as a candidate for District Court Judge, Division K in Lafayette Parish. As we said, you know, it's a very big district, so many people in Lafayette will have this opportunity to look at the election and find out more about you. Now, where should they go to find out more about you?
We do have a Facebook page. It's BO for Judge. Michelle Bio for Judge. Either uh-huh. one, I think, will pull it up.
Okay. I typed that in yes, Facebook, and your website came up.
So either my first and last name or my last name for sure, mm-hmm. Bio for Judge. And then we also have a website. So the same thing, bioforjudge.com.
Okay.
And so it should give you a lot of information. We also have contact information on there. And I really do want to encourage everyone who has questions, please call me. You know, because I really do want to answer your questions if you have questions. I want to make sure that all of the voters in my district feel like they are informed before they go into the voting booth. And, you know, if I don't know the answer to the question, I will look it up and call you
back.
Back
with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I saw your number is 337-315-9877. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Because I know you say it, and there's some really great videos on Facebook, and I found those helped me not only prepare for this interview, but to get to know you better before we sat down.
Well, good. Thank you for looking at them. You know, it's the goal is to try to just tell people about myself and what I, you know, what I've accomplished and what I want to continue to do.
Yeah. I just wish you the best, and thank you again for taking time and having that commitment to make our community better. So,
well, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'd like to thank our listeners. Listening to Discover Lafayette is a great way to learn more about our whole community, about South Louisiana, and people such as Michelle Bio, who are running for office. We have a lot of interviews, over 160 on our website, discoverlafayette.net, and you can meet everybody from Charlie Goodson of Charlie G's to Mark Miller. I know one of your friends, he's in the oil and gas industry. We've had artists, entertainers, just business people from all walks of life, and it's been a real pleasure doing this podcast. I really enjoy Discover Lafayette. So please check out our website, discoverlafayette.net. Even better, and with that, you can subscribe to the podcast any on your device. Just go to your podcast app, type in Discover Lafayette, and it'll be delivered to your phone every Friday morning. Now, this show would not be possible without our sponsors. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, Lafayette General Health, Raider, and in particular, Jason Sikora, who mixes our tape, and Rally Marketing. Their generosity makes this show possible, and I want to express my thanks. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.